Well, good evening, everyone. It is Q&A night tonight, and I just want to start out by thanking you for all of the encouragement and the support that you've shown for the last Q&A night, not only just telling me how much you appreciate what we're doing with this, but also by submitting questions. That's important. It's going to be hard to have Q&A night if there's no Qs. Okay, so we had about 10 questions submitted this time. That's excellent participation. I'm only going to be able to answer 5 questions tonight. Some of those I'm just going to answer in person. Going to be easier to do it that way than from the pulpit. And some of those I'm just going to save until next month. But I appreciate all of your encouragement as we ask questions of God's Word and try to seek out those answers together. So tonight we want to begin in 1 Corinthians 7. In 1 Corinthians 7. And honestly, this is a question that we're going to spend about half of the lesson on tonight. And so if you think, wow, how in the world are we going to spend this much time on each one of these 5 questions? Well, we're not. This one's just very, very involved. Okay? A very good question. Right? Regarding 1 Corinthians 7, verses 12 through 16, there are a couple questions. One, how are the spouse and children made holy? And 2, what does verse 15 mean regarding the right to remarry? In particular, the phrase not under bondage. Okay? And so we want to just start by reading this text. It says in 1 Corinthians 7, verse 12, beginning, "But to the rest I say, not the Lord." Now let me say something preliminarily here. Whenever Paul in this chapter says, "what I say and not the Lord," or "what the Lord says," he's referring to issues that Jesus specifically addressed while he was here in his earthly ministry. So when he says, "to the rest I say, not the Lord," here, he doesn't mean that, well, this is just my opinion, it doesn't count. He's saying this is something Jesus did not specifically address while he was on the earth. So he says, "to the rest I say, not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he must not divorce her. And a woman who has an unbelieving husband, and he consents to live with her, she must not send her husband away. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified through his wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified through her believing husband. For otherwise your children are unclean, but now they are holy. Yet if the unbelieving one leaves, let him leave. The brother or the sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God has called us to peace. For how do you know, O wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, O husband, whether you will save your wife?" So to understand this, we really need to do what we always do in good Bible study, and that's understand the context in which a passage was written. And 1 Corinthians can really be divided up into 2 sections. The first 6 chapters are all things that Paul is rebuking them for, regarding things that he heard from Chloe's household. Okay, in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, Chloe's household reported some things, some sins that were going on, and Paul rebukes them. But then, starting in chapter 7, our chapter, Paul begins to address issues that they specifically asked him about in a letter that they sent him earlier. So look in verse 1 of chapter 7. He says, "Now concerning the things about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman." Now, we don't have the letter that they wrote to Paul, but they obviously wrote him something. And here he's going to address the issue that they wrote to him about, and he's going to continue for the rest of the book using the phrase "now concerning" to introduce new issues that they brought to him and asked him about. We learn here from 1 Corinthians 7, verse 1, that one of those topics was about celibacy, or keeping away from a woman sexually. Apparently, they believed that it was not good to touch a woman. Now, when we think about touching a woman, we just think about giving her a hug or holding her hand or something like that. But the phrase "touching a woman" in that culture meant to have sex with her. In Genesis chapter 20 and verse 6, remember when God told Pharaoh in a dream, he said, "I kept you from touching Sarah." He meant, "I kept you from having sexual relations with her." Now, some have tried to suggest that Paul is the one making the assertion in verse 1 that it is good for a man not to touch a woman. But honestly, if you take that view, it's inconsistent with the rest of the chapter, and that teaching is inconsistent with the rest of the Bible. It's much more accurate to say that the phrase they used when they wrote him that letter was, it is good for a man not to touch a woman, and Paul is responding to it. I'll show you another example of that. Look in chapter 8 in verse 1. Chapter 8 in verse 1. Now concerning, this is a different issue. Now concerning things sacrificed to idols, we know that we all have knowledge. Knowledge makes arrogant, but love edifies. I believe when they wrote Paul that letter, that was the phrase they used. They said, listen, Paul, we know that we all have knowledge. We know that these gods are not real gods, and so we can eat that meat. And Paul addresses that by saying, yeah, but you know what? Knowledge makes arrogant, but love edifies. Okay. Now, to our ears, it seems weird that anybody would say it's good to abstain from sexual relations, especially the Corinthians, because they were well known for their sexual immorality in that culture. But it was actually fairly common among certain philosophical schools, among certain religions, that they taught that it was good to not have sexual intercourse, even in marriage. It's good not to get married. And not only was it a good thing, it was a higher, more spiritual way of life. Now, you know the Corinthians, right? They loved the higher, more spiritual things. They were always bragging about the higher path. They said, listen, I'm of Paul. I'm better than you because he baptized me. Or they would brag about their spiritual gifts. I can speak in tongues, but you can only prophesy. So if there's any teaching in their culture that says, hey, if you do this, you'll be higher in status and you'll be more spiritually minded, you better believe they're going to latch on to that. That's exactly what's going on here. On top of all of that, as Christians, they could look at Jesus and say, look, here's our Lord and Master. He never got married. He was a virgin. And even closer to home, they could look at Paul the Apostle and say, look, he's celibate too. He never had sexual relations. And can I suggest that celibacy may have been one of the things they had in mind when they said, I am of Paul, or I am of Christ, earlier in the chapter. That, folks, is the backdrop for understanding why Paul says what he says in this chapter. And when you really understand that background, it makes everything make perfect sense. Okay? I'll show you this in outline form. In verses 2 through 7, okay, in verses 2 through 7, he addresses married couples in which one of the spouses wants to stay celibate. One spouse thinks, hey, even though we're married, I should just stop having sex so I can live the highest, most spiritual form of life. Well, Paul basically says to them, you can't just decide to do that because your body doesn't belong to you. Your body belongs to your spouse. Do not deprive one another of the sexual relationship. And then in verses 8 and 9, he addresses those who are widows and widowers. He uses the phrase unmarried. Now, unmarried could mean never been married, but he talks about those who've never been married in verse 25, beginning. In their culture, unmarried could also refer to widows and widowers, those Christians who had lost his wife or lost her husband, and the Christian is thinking, it's better that I never get married again and just live the celibate lifestyle. Well, Paul in these verses says it's fine if you want to stay single like me, but if you have a hard time controlling yourself, get married. Better to get married than to burn with passion, Paul says. And that is so practical for widows and widowers, because if you have had a healthy sex life with your spouse for years and then they die, it's going to be way harder not to have that kind of intimate relationship with somebody else moving forward. Their impulses will probably be even harder to control than the single person who's never known the power and the beauty of the sexual relationship the way God designed it. And then in verses 10 and 11, he addresses married couples where both spouses want to become celibate. Both of them say, listen, we want to stop this sexual relationship, but it's too hard in marriage, so guess what? We should get a divorce. Maybe we should just divorce and live single now so that we can live this celibate lifestyle. And here's an interesting note. The reason for divorce here it wasn't for selfish reasons, like it so often is in our culture today. They wanted to get a divorce so they could be more spiritual and closer to the Lord. I think that's kind of an interesting thing to think about. Well, how does Paul address it? Well, he says, you know what? Jesus said, do not get divorced. Don't do it. And then we come to our text, verses 12 through 16. Here he addresses married couples in which one of the spouses is not a Christian. In this situation, the Corinthians would think they should definitely get divorced, because not only are they engaging in sexual intercourse, but now they're doing it with a non-Christian. They'd be thinking the whole marriage is contaminated, not only by the sex, but by an unholy sexual union with a pagan, with an unbeliever. And so, we should just get a divorce. Well, how does Paul address that? He says, don't get divorced. And here's where the language about holiness comes in verse 14, when he says that the unbelieving husband is sanctified by his wife, or made holy by his wife, and vice versa, and the children are holy. But here's the question: does this mean that the unbelieving husband is saved? And the answer is no. It cannot mean that, because he's an unbeliever. An unbeliever, by definition, is lost. Jesus says, unless you believe that I am He, you will die in your sin. So when he says that your unbelieving spouse is made holy, he cannot mean that they're saved. So what does it mean? Well, holy or sanctified in this context seems to mean that the unbeliever is a legitimate marriage partner in God's eyes. In other words, it's not like the unbelieving spouse delegitimizes and contaminates and defiles the whole marriage, making the entire union unholy so that now you have to get divorced. It's not like the unbelieving spouse contaminates your children and makes them illegitimate children in God's eyes. No, if your spouse is not a believer, that is not a sinful union to be broken up. Stay with him or stay with her. So what Paul's saying. And he says in verse 16, besides, you may one day convert that person. Now, here's an important note. He's talking to Christians who were already married to non-Christians. He's not encouraging Christians to marry non-Christians as an evangelism tool. So to sum up, holy here means legitimate as a marriage partner, and for the child, a legitimate part of the family in God's eyes. Now, you may be thinking, well, okay, why is that even an issue? You remember Ezra chapter 10 in the Old Testament? God forced the Israelites to divorce their wives and their husbands and to put away all the pagan wives and children because those children were illegitimate, those spouses were illegitimate. Paul says that's not the case here. You stay with them, they're holy, they're fine in God's eyes. And plus, you might save them someday. They may start to believe someday. Now, as to the second part of the question, verse 15 is kind of a parenthetical statement in this text. It's like a just-in-case statement. So that just in case the unbelieving spouse decides to leave, the Christian is, quote, not under bondage in such cases. And the second part of this question is, does this phrase mean that the Christian is free to get remarried if the unbelieving spouse leaves? Now, I promise you that I am not belittling whoever asked this question. It really is an excellent, excellent question. But I want to take this opportunity to share with you all a very important principle of Bible study. And that is that we can make a text mean whatever we want it to mean depending on the question we ask of it. I'll give you a simple example. Let's say you read a text message from a woman. And this text message from a woman says, I'm too busy. That's all the message says. Now, let's say you read that text and you ask this question of the text. Will this woman go out on a date with me next Friday night? Well, now the meaning of that text is, no, she won't, because she's too busy. And there's kind of an implied meaning she's not interested in me either, because she didn't like schedule, you know, a different night or something like that, right? But what if I ask this question of the text? Is this woman interested in coming to worship God on Sunday or Wednesday? Well, now the text means she doesn't care about the Lord. She may still be interested in dating me, but she doesn't care about God. She's too busy to come to worship. But do you see how the question that I bring to that text actually changes the meaning of that text? Because what we do so often is we ask a question of a text, assuming that text was written to answer our question, and it wasn't. Maybe that woman just said, "I'm too busy," because she was venting. And she was just frustrated with a busy schedule. She just wanted you to listen and to say, "I'm sorry that you're so busy. I know this must be very overwhelming and exhausting for you." Maybe that was the original intention. And that's what we always have to do with the text, is find out the original intention. Because the Bible was not written to answer our specific questions in the present day. It really wasn't. It gives us all the answers, but only indirectly, as we seek to discover the original intention of the authors when they first wrote it. And with that said, this is such a common question people bring to verse 15. They ask, "Can I get remarried if an unbelieving spouse leaves me?" And then they turn to verse 15 and they say, "Hey, I'm not under bondage in such cases, so Paul says I can get remarried." Again, I'm not belittling that or making light of this question. It's a good question. It's just a perfect example of a good question asked of the wrong text. This chapter was not written to address our questions about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. It was written to address two things, one of which I've talked about already. There's another one I want to introduce, but it goes hand in hand. The first is celibacy. The second is changing one's station in life to improve your social or spiritual status. You see, these two concepts go hand in hand in this chapter. The reason they want to get divorced and to stay celibate is so that they can move up in status in society, so they could be closer to the Lord and more spiritually minded. And so what Paul also does in this chapter is he teaches an overarching principle that Christians should stay where they are and not try to change their social position thinking that they'll be better Christians for it. Many thought, "I'll change my marital status and be closer to God," or "I'll change my status as a slave or as a Gentile or as married to non-married." And Paul says none of that means anything to God. And that's why, encouched right in the middle of this chapter, it actually interrupts the celibacy discussion. And then the celibacy discussion picks back up in verse 25, is this principle. Look what he says, beginning of verse 17. "Only as the Lord has assigned to each one, as God has called each, in this manner let him walk. And so I direct in all the churches. Was any man called when he was already circumcised? He's not to become uncircumcised. Has anyone been called in uncircumcision? He's not to be circumcised. Circumcision is nothing. Uncircumcision is nothing. But what matters is the keeping of the commandments of God. Each man must remain in that condition in which he was called." In other words, whatever station in life you were in when you became a Christian, stay in that position. You don't have to change it in order to draw closer to God or in order to have some higher status. God does not care where you're at socially in life. You are still a Christian. Continue in verse 21. "Were you called while a slave? Do not worry about it. But if you're able also to become free, rather do that. For he who was called in the Lord while a slave is the Lord's freedman. Likewise, he who was called while free is Christ's slave. You were bought with a price. Do not become slaves of men. Brethren, each one is to remain with God in that condition in which he was called." See that? He says, don't become slaves of men. Don't let our society tell you that you got to be in this particular social situation to be a good Christian or to have high status. Don't be slaves to all of that. Just do what the Lord says. And so you ask, well, what does that have to do with anything? Well, because the phrase in verse 15, "not under bondage," in the context of this chapter, in the principle found, is that you're not under bondage to stay where you are in life. You're not under bondage to follow this principle that Paul is teaching, to just remain where you are. If you were married to a pagan when you became a Christian, Paul says, stay where you are. He says, stay in that marriage. Don't try to change your marital status by leaving or sending your spouse away. However, if your unbelieving spouse decides to leave, you can't do anything about it. You can't force him or her to stay with you. And in that case, you're not changing your own status. That person is changing it for you because they're leaving. And you're not under bondage to hold them there and to keep them captive and say, no, we will stay in the same condition. You will stay with me in this marriage, he said, because we're called to peace. you can't just fight your way to keep that person. But here's the thing, if that other person leaves you, you cannot get remarried. He already covered that in verses 10 and 11. And just like Jesus said during his earthly ministry, he covered it too. Folks, I'll tell you, there are a lot of people in the religious world who take "not under bondage" here to mean the marriage is ended once your non-Christian spouse leaves you and now you're free to remarry. But I'll tell you, not a single one of those arguments holds up to any scrutiny, because it disrespects the context of 1 Corinthians 7. And you know what it also does? It sets up a different standard of marriage for Christians and non-Christians. And when Jesus was asked about marriage in Matthew 19, what was the standard that he used for explaining why marriage is permanent? Genesis 2, which means it applies to all mankind, Jew, Gentile, Christian, non-Christian. Marriage is designed to be permanent. And that's the answer to the first question. Again, I told you not all the rest of the questions will be this long. That's intense. That's intense Bible study. And I'm glad we get to do this on Q&A night. I could have just told you the answer and then moved on. I don't want to do that. I want you to really learn how to dig into the text and study these issues out for yourself. This is why there's so many denominations, people just listening to what their preachers say, listening to what their families say, and they're not digging into the text themselves. I want to help you learn how to do that. And if you disagree with something I say, then bring it up to me afterwards. Let's study this further. Okay, there's a lot more I could have said, all right, about this text, but I tried to condense it down. All right, very involved answer there. All right, second question. If the government we are told to submit to becomes extremely corrupt and evil, can we revolt as Christians? You know, do we just kind of suffer in silence? After all, this country was founded by a revolt against a monarchy. What's another good question? And I think it's helpful to define some terms, okay? Because there is a difference between rebelling and revolting. To rebel means to refuse to obey authority. To revolt means to try to destroy or overthrow that authority. You know, a child is rebelling. You tell them not to do something, or you tell them to do something, and you say, "No, I'm not going to do it." They're rebelling. A child is revolting when you tell them to do something, they say, "Nope, I'm not going to do it," and then they try to attack their parents and say, "Well, I'll show you who's boss. You're not going to tell me what it is." That's a revolt. Okay. Here's the kind of the short answer, and then we'll look at some scriptures to back it up. Christians can rebel, but only under certain circumstances. But there is no condition under which a Christian can revolt. Look in 1 Peter 2. All right, 1 Peter 2. Here's a good passage to start with here. 1 Peter 2. And of course, this is during the terrible persecution by the Emperor Nero, persecuting Christians, putting them to death. And listen to what Peter says in 1 Peter 2, verses 13 through 16. He says, "Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king or as to one in authority, or to governors as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers or the praise of those who do right. For such is the will of God, that by doing right you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. Act as free men, and do not use your freedom as a covering for evil, but use it as bondslaves of God. Honor all people, love the brotherhood, fear God, and honor to the king." Okay? It's important to remember that Peter said this when the Romans were the governing authorities, and they were very corrupt. They are very wicked. Revelation calls them the beast. They were actually torturing and killing Christians. And note, Peter still says submit to them and do what's right. He doesn't say convert as many Christians as you can, gather as many weapons as you can, and start training for war so you can overthrow those wicked Romans and to go start your own peaceful society. He even tells them in this letter they should be willing to die for their belief in Jesus at the hands of the wicked government. But then you also have a verse like Acts 4, which is all very familiar to us. You don't even have to turn there, really. But Peter and John, they're before the Sanhedrin Council. And the Sanhedrin Council is the Jewish governing body. And they tell them, "Listen, you can't preach Christ anymore. And they say, oh yeah, well, you think we should listen to God or you think we should listen to you? And of course, that's a rhetorical question. And so the point is, they actually rebelled when they were asked to sin. And we too, folks, if our government either asks us to sin or asks us to stop doing what is right, we can rebel against that. If our government says, Brian, listen, it's illegal to preach that homosexuality is a sin, I'm going to rebel against that, even if it means I end up in prison. Okay? But I'm not going to start assassinating liberal political leaders. Okay? That's a revolt. That's different. Christians in the first century were persecuted and even killed by corrupt governments, but they never revolted. They rebelled by continuing to worship and continuing to spread Jesus Christ, even if it meant being hung on crosses and fed to lions. Now, as to the point about our country's history, in our society, of course, in our schools and everything, we're taught to glorify everything that is American, even some of the famous revolts and revolutions of our past. But we need to remember some of those revolts from our past were things Christians had no business being a part of, even though in America there's nothing more glorious than revolting for our personal freedom. I know that's an important American principle, but in the New Testament, it doesn't seem very important to God. It doesn't seem very glorious to God for Christians to be involved in that. Now, need to make this last note on this question. Our country is truly special and unique from so many of the dictatorships and the monarchies of the past and even of the present, because we're a democracy. That certainly was foreign to the Bible times, and America does provide ways within the confines of our own laws to affect change. Some might see Christians, you know, signing petitions against abortion as revolting, but I would argue that's not revolting at all. That's not even really rebelling. That's exercising the right we have in a democracy to use our voices to promote change in society. When we vote to bring a new president into office, we're not revolting and trying to overthrow the president's authority. Well, no, we're just using our right here in this country to have a say in who leads us. If as Christians we leave, and let's say we leave America and we go decide to live somewhere else, that's not really rebelling or revolting, because our country doesn't even tell us, if you're an American, you have to stay in America and you cannot ever leave. So we could leave. Our government, if it does become so corrupt, we do have ways to promote change without revolting that countries in the past never had, and countries even today still don't have. That is a great, great blessing, folks. Third question, why do innocent children who have no sin get sick and die? Now, I have to say, first of all, that the answer I give here is not intended to provide comfort in any way to anybody who has lost a child. Despite the fact that there is an answer to this question, it's always going to hurt, it's always going to be confusing, and I want to express my deepest sympathies to anybody who has ever experienced that kind of pain. But the answer really is found in Genesis 3. In Genesis 3, after man sinned in the garden, remember in verses 17 through 19, death entered the world. Man would return to the dust. Right? Even the ground was cursed. So it wasn't just man, it wasn't just woman, it was even the ground. It was the whole creation that was cursed. And before the curse, you know, there was no death. There was no disease. There was no sickness. But now that death enters the world, these things are all a reality for us. And here's a question that will put this in perspective, all right? How come animals get sick and die? You ever think about that? Animals are not moral beings. They never do anything wrong. They don't sin. Tim has pointed this out to me. Animals are the only ones on this earth that do what God actually tells them to do. Man, we're the ones that don't, okay? So why in the world do animals get sick and die when they're innocent? Well, because they're affected by the curse of sin. Look in Romans 8, a really interesting verse here, passage in Romans 8. He's talking about how much as Christians, we're looking forward to the glory that's going to come in heaven. And he says that famous verse in verse 18 where he says, I consider the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed to us. But notice what he says in beginning in verse 19. He says, for the anxious longing of the creation waits eagerly for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope that the creation itself also will be set free from its slavery to corruption into the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groans and suffers the pains of childbirth together until now. See, he says it's not just Christians who are longing for Jesus to come back so that all of this pain and vanity and futility will end. He says even the animals, all of creation, are longing for Jesus to come back so that we will no longer be living under the curse of sin. Again, I understand knowing this doesn't make it any easier when a child dies. But sinless children, well, they get sick and die because they're affected by the curse of death. It was brought on by Adam and Eve's sin, and it was brought on by our sin as well. And some children get sick and die as a direct result of their mother's sin. Maybe their mother, you know, did drugs and alcohol while she was pregnant, and that child suffered the immediate consequences of that. That sometimes happens, but other times you can have the sweetest mom in the world, somebody who tries to serve the Lord, who tries to live right, and maybe she gives birth and it's a miscarriage, or the child is deformed, or it has some terminal disease. Well, that's just because we're living in this horribly cursed world by our sin. It's an indirect result of this vain and futile and painful place. But it's also a world that God promises us release from if we'll only put our faith in Jesus Christ and live for Him, so that one day we can be in heaven, whereas Revelation 22 and verse 4 says there is no more curse. We'll be free from it. Fourth question, how do I find a sound congregation when traveling? And can I worship there if they have a recreation center? This is an example. I'm sure you could fill in the blank with any sort of illustration there, but rec center. Okay, well, let me see the first part of this question about how to find a sound congregation. Most churches these days, let me give you a couple suggestions. Most churches have websites. So if you're traveling, you can Google churches in your area, and you can go online and find out a lot about what they believe and what they practice and whether they're a sound congregation. Secondly, you can ask around if you know people who have traveled to that area before. If you know that there are people who live in that area who share similar beliefs, well, you can ask them for recommendations about good congregations in the area. And if those things don't yield results, there is actually a website, did you know this, called www.findthechurch.com. And it's run by a man named Thomas Lehman. I don't know this man, but it apparently attempts to list all of the sound congregations in this country. Palm Springs Drive is actually on that website. But of course, folks, there is a major caveat here, and that is who gets to decide, you know, which congregations make the cut for the sound congregations in this country. I mean, what one person, what one organization can look out and say, I deem that all of these particular churches in these particular locations are the sound ones. I don't know Thomas Lehman. I'm sure he's a good brother, and I don't know the process he went through. Maybe he looked at the signs that they had on their building. Maybe he went to their website. Maybe he spent a really long time. He did mention he had an old Guardian of Truth directory, for those of you who remember those, okay, but the truth is really only Jesus can determine all the sound congregations in the world, all right? So this website is helpful. It's a good resource, but just, you know, it's up to you to use your Bible to find the truth, whether these congregations are teaching sound doctrine or not. Regarding the second part of that question, did I click that earlier? Okay, I'll give you a second. Can't remember if I clicked that. All right, second part of the question. Honestly, this is a matter with the rec center. You know, this is a matter of one's individual conscience. Not should the church have a rec center. I'm not saying that's a matter of conscience. I believe that is a scriptural issue. I think that's sinful. But the issue of, well, am I passing through on vacation? Can I worship there? Can I just go in the building and enjoy worship with them at the rec center? I believe that's a conscience issue. Truth be told, it could be hard, even impossible, to find a congregation that believes and practices everything exactly the same as we believe and practice, since we're all autonomous. But again, it's up to you to determine if they're following the Bible or not. If they're not following the Bible, okay, like for instance in the example of the rec center, then you have to determine if you can worship with them without participating in the error. You see, some Christians believe that if I worship there, if I'm just in the building singing or whatever, or praying, I'm automatically showing approval to and participating in everything that they're doing, so I just can't go there at all. Now, if that is your belief, then by all means, don't go there. You can worship with your family in your car. You can you can have your church service in the hotel room, wherever you're staying on your travels. Okay, so if that is a violation of your conscience, then don't do it. But in the example of the recreation center, I personally, as a matter of my own conscience, believe that I could worship there without participating in that. Now, would I put money in the collection plate when it went by? No. Because then I would be actively participating in things I know they're not spending the money on properly. Okay. I'm also, if I have kids, I'm probably not going to let them go play on the jungle gym afterwards. They're going to think I'm the meanest ever, but it's going to be hard to condemn something and then, you know, enjoy the benefits of it. I would also point out there's a difference between worshiping somewhere, passing through while traveling, and then actually placing membership. You know, when we have visitors to our congregation, we do. We have regular visitors. I don't ever assume when there's a visitor here, oh, they approve of everything we're doing, and they just love everything that's going on here. I don't know that. I don't know them. I don't make that assumption. I just assume, well, they're passing through and they're looking for a place to worship, and that's fine. But if they come to me and say, Brian, we really want to place membership here, we really want to work and worship with this congregation regularly, then I'm more inclined to believe they approve of the things that they've seen here. And they really do believe that these are scriptural things. So, again, that's just me. When I go to a congregation to worship with them, I don't necessarily automatically feel like I'm participating in approving of all the things that they do with their treasury and all the beliefs that they have. But if you do have that feeling, if you feel like being in the building while worship is going on and being with those brethren means that you do approve and participate, well, then by all means, don't worship there. Okay, find somewhere else. And fifth and finally, save the most fun one for last maybe, why did God allow men to marry multiple wives in the Old Testament? Why did he do that? Well, let me give you a quick principle here in Matthew 19. Look there in Matthew 19. This is really about marriage, divorce, and remarriage in Matthew 19, but Jesus really teaches us an important principle here. And that principle really is that just because God allowed something in the Old Testament, it doesn't mean that it was ideal, or it doesn't mean that it was a part of his original intention. And this issue of divorce comes up, and they say in verse 7 and 8 in Matthew 19, they said to him, why then did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce and send her away? And Jesus said to them, because of the hardness of your heart, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it has not been this way. So in other words, just because God allowed them to give certificates of divorce to their wives when they sent them away doesn't mean God actually wanted them to get a divorce. God never commanded them to get a divorce. It's just they were already divorcing and it was rampant. And so God, he put in a command about giving the certificate of divorce to protect the woman. You see, because husbands were fickle, and they would divorce their wives, and then the wife would get remarried, and then the husband would come along and say, hey, that's my wife, I'm taking her back. And back then, of course, women didn't have much say in this at all, so it was really one-sided. And so God says, if you divorce your wife and you give her one of these certificates of divorce, she can remarry and she's not yours anymore. Don't be going to try to bring her back. So God had actually put that in place to protect the woman. But the Pharisees twisted that and they said, oh, God says we can get a divorce for whatever we want. We just give her a certificate of divorce. No. Not God's original intention. It wasn't the ideal. And where did Jesus go for the ideal plan of marriage? Well, he went to Genesis 2. In verses 4 and 5, he answered and said, have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female? And said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Here is God's ideal for marriage. And likewise, folks, I believe it's reasonable to assume that polygamy was also a concession on God's part, allowing people to have multiple wives, maybe even to aid them in the command to be fruitful and multiply. Maybe that's behind it. There's been some guesses as to, well, what maybe was God trying to accomplish with that. I think that's fair. But I don't see any command in the Old Testament where God says, you better make sure to marry multiple wives. Don't see that anywhere. And it definitely was not the ideal situation. And we know that for several reasons. First of all, in the very beginning, when God saw that Adam needed companionship, how many women did he give to Adam in the garden? Just one. Only one. Secondly, it never worked out well for any man in the Old Testament who had, I'm sorry, women, it just never worked out well for any man with multiple wives in the Old Testament. And the men, you know, we get confused about that. We think, man, that'd be so awesome to be Jacob and have all these women fighting over time in bed with me. How did that turn out for him? Not well. All kinds of tension, all kinds of jealousy and hatred and trickery and sadness. Or we think, man, it'd be awesome to be Solomon. He had 700 wives and 300 concubines. He could sleep with 1,000 women any time that he wanted. How did that go for Solomon? Destroyed him. Destroyed him. Heart turned away from the Lord. And that's why, thirdly, even though God allowed multiple wives, there were warnings about it scattered throughout his word. Like, for instance, in Deuteronomy 17:17, he tells the king, do not multiply wives for yourself. Now, I think this is probably anticipating the king trying to make political peace with the foreign nations by marrying their daughters, and they're marrying pagan women, and those pagan women would turn their hearts away from God. But folks, even if in the Old Testament you were to marry multiple wives who shared your same religious beliefs, who were all Israelites, it would still be disastrous. You look at David, he had multiple wives, and yet what does he do? What's the source of his downfall as king? He still wants another woman. You think, well, he'd be happy. He's got all these women. And yet he still wants another one that doesn't... He wants somebody else's wife? That's so confusing. Well, it's not confusing when you understand what that really does to you. And look at one last verse. Look in Proverbs 31. I want to preach a whole sermon on that. Our culture, this is our culture in a nutshell. Not with polygamy, but with pornography and with all this fornication and multiple partners and trying to find satisfaction. Listen to what he tells the king in Proverbs 31. We often think about the beautiful wife at the end. And that's great. But notice what he says in verse 3. He says, do not give your strength to women or your ways to that which destroy kings. Now remember, this is Hebrew poetry. That's parallelism. He's saying women destroy kings when the king is focused on them too much. And he turned their attention. Again, I'm not trying to insult the ladies. You're beautiful. God created you for divine purposes. But the truth is, if we as men turn our affection toward too many women, and we make women and sexual pleasure with women the focus of our lives, it will destroy us. In other words, ladies, we can only handle one of you. And that's, again, why God in the very beginning gave Adam Eve and not two Eves or not three Eves. If you have your songbooks, we're going to sing a song of encouragement. Maybe this is a good time to just point out that God's way is best. God really knows what's best for our lives, and we so often want to do things our way, and we look out and say, well, this is going to give me pleasure, and this is going to make me happy, this is going to satisfy me. And God says, nonsense. You need to go back to the beginning. You need to go back to my word. I'll tell you what you need for satisfaction, and what we ultimately need is the forgiveness in Christ and the hope of heaven. And if you don't have that, you can have that tonight by believing in Jesus, being baptized into him for the forgiveness of your sins. And if you've done that and wandered off, we invite you back home. Come forward. We can help you while we stand and sing.